going to read the introduction from the book Vesper Flights by Helen MacDonald. This is Maggie Jones. Back in the 16th century, a curious craze began to spread through the halls and palaces and houses of Europe. It was a type of collection kept often in ornate wooden cases, and it was known as Wunderkammer, a cabinet of curiosities. Although the direct translation from the German captures better its purpose, cabinet of wonders. It was expected that people should pick up and handle the objects in these cases, feel their textures, their weights, their particular strangenesses. Nothing was kept behind glass, as in a modern museum or gallery. More importantly, perhaps, neither were these collections organized according to the museological classifications of today. Wunderkammern held natural and artificial things, together on shelves in close conjunction. Pieces of coral, fossils, ethnographic artifacts, cloaks, miniature paintings, musical instruments, mirrors, preserved specimens of fish and birds, insects, rocks, feathers. The wonder these collections kindled came in part from the ways in which their disparate contents spoke to one another of their similarities and differences in form, their beauties and manifest obscurities. I hope that this book works a little like a Wunderkammer. It's full of strange things and is concerned with the quality of wonder. Someone once told me that every writer has a subject that underlies everything they write. It can be love or death, betrayal or belonging, home or hope or exile. I choose to think that my subject is love, and most specifically love for the glittering world of non-human life around us. Before I was a writer, I was a historian of science, which was an eye-opening occupation. We tend to think of science as unalloyed, objective truth, but of course the questions it has asked of the world have quietly and often invisibly been inflected by history, culture, and society. Working as an historian of science revealed to me how we have always unconsciously and inevitably viewed the natural world as a mirror of ourselves, reflecting our own worldview and our own needs, thoughts, and hopes. Many of the essays here are exercises in interrogating such human ascriptions and assumptions. Most of all, I hope my work is about a thing that seems to me of the deepest possible importance in our present-day historical moment, finding ways to recognize and love difference, the attempt to see through eyes that are not your own, to understand that your way of looking at the world is not the only one, to think what it might mean to love those that are not like you, to rejoice in the complexity of things. Science encourages us to reflect upon the size of our lives in relation to the vastness of the universe or the bewildering multitudes of microbes that exist inside our bodies, and it reveals to us a planet that is beautifully and insistently not human. It was science that taught me how the flights of tens of millions of migrating birds across Europe and Africa, lines on the map drawn in lines of feather and starlight and bone, are stranger and more astonishing than I could ever have imagined. For these creatures navigate by visualizing the Earth's magnetic field through detecting quantum entanglement taking place in the receptor cells of their eyes. What science does is what I would like more literature to do too, show us that we are living in an exquisitely complicated world that is not all about us. It does not belong to us alone. It never has done. These are terrible times for the environment. Now more than ever before, we need to look long and hard at how we view and interact with the natural world. We're living through the world's sixth great extinction, one caused by us. The landscapes around us grow emptier and quieter each passing year. We need hard science to establish the rate and scale of these declines, to work out why it is occurring and what mitigation strategies can be brought into play. But we need literature, too. We need to communicate what the losses mean. I think of the wood warbler, a small citrus-colored bird fast disappearing from British forests. It is one thing to show the statistical facts about this species' decline. It's another thing to communicate to people what wood warblers are and what that loss means, when your experience of a wood that is made of light and leaves and song becomes something less complex, less magical, just less, once the warblers have gone. Literature can teach us the qualitative texture of the world, and we need it too. We need to communicate the value of things that more of us might fight to save them. And that's the introduction to Helen MacDonald's wonderful book, Vesper Flights. And now I have an essay of my own to read that's appropriate for this winter season about great horned owls and bald eagles. The soft hoot of the great horned owl is lovely to hear. I hope you hear it occasionally. Late fall and winter are a good time to go out before dusk and listen for them, keeping contact. The female is larger than the male. Her voice is higher pitched than her smaller mate, whose voice is deeper. If you hear them both, you can tell the female from the male. A rare treat. Sometimes you can recognize individuals by variations in their calls that are unique. Now during these short days and cold nights, great horned owls are courting and preparing to lay eggs very soon. What a survival strategy for a bird, lay eggs in February. This does give them a jump on the long weeks and months they'll be raising their young throughout spring, summer, and into the fall. Owls and falcons don't build their own nests. They will find a nest built by other creatures, crows, red-tailed hawks, squirrels' nests. They'll use large cavities in trees, ledges and potholes on quarry and cliff walls. She does all the incubation of the eggs for over a month, and when the three or four young hatch, she stays with them constantly, keeping them covered with her warm down and thick outer plumage. She's entirely dependent on her mate to bring her food, and when there are more hungry mouths to feed, he must bring more and more food. When the young are about a month old, grown enough to keep themselves warm, she'll finally leave the nest and join her mate, and I'm sure find her favorite stream for a good bath. You might spot any of our owls perched out hunting during the day. Rodents are a principal food source for all predators. They supply every nutrient needed to grow and thrive. If we had smaller mowed lawns around our houses in rural areas, wildlife would benefit greatly from having more space for rodent hunting. Great horned owls eat a very wide variety of prey. Almost anything out and about, including other raptors, ducks, snakes, insects, rabbits, and squirrels. Coincidentally, our bald eagles start laying their eggs at about this same time. Unlike the owls, the male will relieve the female occasionally for incubation duties, turning the eggs carefully before settling down. In our area, our eagles will lay eggs starting in mid-February. Usually it's two eggs that come 3 to 5 days apart. And like great horned owls, they start incubation with the first egg. This way, the chicks hatch at those same intervals, and the first chick will be bigger than the second, which comes along a day or two or three later. Compare this to birds like geese and ducks, who lay a clutch of eggs over a period of many days, but don't incubate until the last egg is laid. All the chicks will hatch at about the same time. This is very different strategy used by birds that are more fully developed when they hatch and can leave the nest quickly and go with the parents to find food. Young great horned owls and bald eagles are completely helpless at hatching and dependent on their parents for months. After weeks growing in the nest, when they finally begin flying for the young owls, that's the start of their important but difficult life lessons. The adults will bring food to the now fledged young, who perch near each other and emit loud screeches, food begging screeches. If you hear this in spring, it can be confusing. What is that crazy sound? As time goes on, they will start to make their own attempts to catch prey. It takes skill, luck, and repeated attempts at chasing and finally successfully capturing and subduing their next meal. Prey animals have well-developed evasive techniques. They do not make it easy. Most of the young raptors don't live for a full year, the rigors and dangers being too much. But the few who do survive that first year have an excellent chance of surviving to become adults ready to breed. Bald eagles won't be a breeding age until they are 5 or 6 years old, and their plumage changes during each of their many juvenile years, making it clear to other eagles their status. Great horned owls breed when they're approximately 2 years old. So now on these short, cold days and long nights during the next snowstorm with fierce winter winds, think about what it takes for wintertime breeding birds to make it in this world. This is the end of my first installment on WDRT that I call Natural Wonders. I was so pleased to find Helen McDonald's piece that I read today because it describes so well what I hope to accomplish, making vivid the things I marvel at and am still learning about in the natural world. Thank you for listening.